Hi, this is Stephanie Manassas. I am interviewing Dwayne Norby in Squim, Washington, and the interview is taking place on January 14th, 2012. So if you can start off, Mr. Norby, just tell me a little bit about where you were born, what day you were born on, and a little bit about your family size growing up, please.
Well, I was born on February 20th, 1945, in Webster, South Dakota, which is probably about 150 miles, almost straight, south of Fargo. And I had one half-brother, and of course, mother and father, and then that was the family. He was 2 years older than I, and we lived in that area, well, until I went into service, I guess. Then I lived 2 more years there when I got out and then came to Washington State, so that was pretty much it.
And so when you graduated from high school, that would have been 1963, if my math is right?
Well, I actually dropped out, and I got my GED in the service, and then I went to college later.
Okay. So tell me about your decision to join the military.
Well, I think it was just to get out of home and get away from there and things. Parents were having some problems, and I just decided to go some other place. You know, there wasn't jobs around for 17-year-olds, so I thought I would join the service, and that's what I did. I went to Fargo and went to the recruiting station and went to the first service I seen, which was in the Army, and he was out to lunch, and went to the Navy, and he had some problems because I dropped out of high school. Next one and down the line was the Marine Corps, so I went in there and I became a Marine.
And so at the time, you could become a Marine at 17 years old?
I would say half our platoon was about 17 years old, maybe more than that. Maybe like 60% was high school dropouts. You know, this was 1962. And, yeah, I mean, all my closest friends, I remember, were dropouts. We got together the other day, and a couple months ago, and, yeah, they were from California dropouts too. So yeah, a lot of the service people were in those days. You know, nowadays I understand you got to have a high school education, mm-hmm. but not then.
And so, what month in 1962 was it that you enlisted?
February.
February of 1962. So that would have been your junior year of high school.
Yeah, it would have been, yes.
And when did you decide to quit school?
Oh, probably a couple months before that. You know, I think I quit in like December. Yeah, maybe December or something.
And had you thought about getting work and just couldn't find something, and that's why the service came up as an alternative, or did you think immediately about the service?
I think I thought more about the service immediately because, in the middle of winter in Dakota there, in a small town, which we lived around, there was not much to do, and you're outside a lot of the time it would be or whatever. So no, I just thought of going some other place and leaving there. So yeah, no, I didn't think about staying around really.
And then tell me about what happened after you enlisted in Fargo.
Well, I went home for a month, and then I think we went up to a small town somewhere about 40 miles from where I live, and the bus to Minneapolis. They gave me a ticket, you know, and told you how to get there. It said, take this bus here or whatever. Went to Minneapolis and stayed for a night, and then got sworn in the next day, I guess. And then that evening, I took an airplane to San Diego.
And from there, you went to Camp Pendleton?
Well, no, boot camp for 3-4 months is MCRD in San Diego.
Okay, and what
is... After you get out of boot camp, you go to ITR, Infantry Training Regiment, for like a month. Then you take leave, and then you go to Camp Pendleton and get into a unit, you know, or whatever unit they may assign you to. It could be, you know, some other place in the United States, but anyway.
So with boot camp, what does MCRD stand for?
Marine Corps Recruit Depot.
Okay, so that was in San Diego where you did your boot camp?
Yes, yeah, there's two in the United States, you know, Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and MCRD in San Diego are the two boot camps for the Marine Corps.
And so how long were you in boot camp?
Oh, been many years ago, but I think it was probably about three and a half about 3 months of boot camp and then 1 month of infantry training regiment up in, and that was held in Pendleton in that last month. It's kind of like boot camp, yet they treat you almost like recruits yet, so.
And I'm sorry, where was the ITR at?
Camp Pendleton, and I think it was Las Pulgas. You know, Camp Pendleton is made up of a bunch of smaller camps, but it was on the Camp Pendleton base anyway.
So what was your most memorable experience during boot camp?
Well, I probably couldn't tell you. I'd get people in trouble, I think, maybe if I did. Seriously. Probably mine was getting really sick one day, probably as sick as I ever was when I was younger, and they thought I had bronchial pneumonia, and I got put in the hospital right away. And my drill instructor came about 3 hours later and said, you know, none of his blankety-blank recruits ever stayed in the hospital, and took me out of there. And it wasn't just to go to the barrack. We were at the rifle range at the time to go to the tent, but to go out and run with the platoon. And I remember running for like 2 minutes, and I just passed out my feet. I woke up. I didn't remember that, but that's what had to happen, because I woke up in a ditch vomiting. And I remember he didn't even slow the platoon down. I had to catch up to the platoon running up some small hills and that, and running like a drunk. I had no energy or anything. But, you know, that was probably the worst memory I had in there. That it just, you know, you just did it, you know. But the sickest, probably the sickest I ever was when I was young, and that's what I had to do, you know. And other people did too. It wasn't just me.
And so did you end up, do you think you actually had bronchial pneumonia at the time?
Well, that's what the corpsman said. He said you were so close to bronchial pneumonia. You know, they don't put you in the hospital very quickly in the service.
Mm-hmm.
And he almost immediately, after they did some tests on things and put me in. But I think I was in there like 2-3 hours, and then the drill instructor came, and, you know.
Wow. When you were in boot camp, did you have any second thoughts about your decision to join the military?
Well, probably 400 or 500.
Okay. that's pretty common, I hear, in boot camp.
Yeah, yes, it is. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think especially being, of course, a lot of us were 17. I think if you came from Chicago or came from New York or something, it's a little bit different. But for all of us that came from smaller towns in the Midwest, we had no idea what the military was like in those days. You know, you didn't see as much on TV as you do nowadays and stuff like that. So it was kind of a surprise for me and for a lot of people, you know. But, you get through it, and I don't know how you look back on it. With some positive and some negative. It's something I wouldn't mind being in the – I would never want to be a career service person. I wouldn't mind being in the Marine Corps too much again. I would never want to go to boot camp again.
What was the positives that you got out of boot camp?
Well, I think seeing the city of San Diego, even just flying in there, and the Marine Corps recruit depot was a beautiful big place. I mean, this grinder is where they march the troops on that huge, and these buildings that were stucco, you know, they were smooth stucco, like that type of material. I don't know what you call it, but beautiful, a beautiful base down there. And I think we did 2 or 3 things that I remember coming from the small town in the Midwest I'd never seen before. But we had a hypnotist that put on the show for the Marines one night. I never forgot that. It was really interesting. And we went to, I think, one movie. And I've seen it twice since, and I enjoyed it then, and I enjoyed it now. And that was Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy and, you know, the Scopes Monkey Trial. A good movie. Those things stuck in my mind. And the beauty of the base in San Diego and, the, you know, the sunshiny weather even in March and April at times. And so there was some positive. I don't have a lot because they harassed you most of the time, and you had to run wherever you went, and it was pretty regimented. The food wasn't bad. I didn't think the food was bad all throughout the Marine Corps. But, there was some positives in there.
Okay, so tell me then, how long were you in ITR?
ITR, was about a month.
Okay.
And that infantry training regiment was, we learned to shoot different weapons, like the bazookas and different machine guns. And we didn't do too much maneuvers. It was mainly, from what I remember, weapons and stuff like that. And it was up on Camp Pendleton. I almost remember we had this sergeant who got us up every morning. If you ever seen those corrugated buildings, and they would take a baton, military baton, they'd be able to rake it across that building to get you up. And then the sergeant we had was interesting. I think he was from South America someplace, and he would holler into the barracks. You know, he didn't speak very good English. He said, okay, you effing Marines, you know, time to get up and shower and shave. He had a C on each one of those. But he had, interesting fellow, he had trained in Mao Zedong's School of Guerrilla Warfare over in China with Che Guevara. So he was quite an experienced fellow. I mean, he had some push behind him. That's one of my big memories of that place was him and getting up every day.
Now, how old was he about at the time?
I'm guessing he was probably 33, 34, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did he have any kind moments of compassion, or was that not part of his personality?
Well, we never, you know, it seemed like the only thing I can mainly remember was that of him. So I don't have any really negatives or positives, just that, you know, you kind of, when this Mao Zedong School of Warfare in China with Che Guevara, I never know where Che Guevara was at the time, but you know, you just kind of looked up to him. Yeah, the ITR was not like boot camp. It was probably only 70% as bad as boot camp. You had a little bit of freedom, and you had a couple weekend passes. So mainly, I thought the sergeants up there, you know, they were still strict in that, but it wasn't like boot camp. So I didn't have too bad of memories of, you know, just maybe one or two of sergeants up there. You know, it wasn't too bad.
Now, what did you do on your weekend passes?
Well, went to Disneyland one weekend.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one I remember, of course. And then as a 17-year-old, it was fascinating, you know, coming from the Midwest. It, what a memory going there. You know, got a motel, and a couple of us paid for a cab and took it in, and got a motel, and then spent a day or two at Disneyland and had a good time.
I could see why that would be memorable.
Yes, yeah.
All right, so then tell me more about what happened after ITR.
Well, after ITR, we got our leave, of course. I took the Santa Fe train to Kansas City, and then to I took another train to Minneapolis, and then I guess we had to take a bus from Minneapolis to home. And after ITR, when you got your assignments, I guess, to your different groups, and of course, most of the people who graduated from MCRD stayed on the West Coast, and those that graduate from Lejeune stay on the East Coast, but some who got into aircraft, whatever, went back east. But I got assigned to the infantry, and then Camp Pendleton, Camp Margarita, which is one of the smaller camps inside Pendleton, and stayed there for I guess a year and a half, and was a infantryman there, you know, in training there.
Okay, tell me more about what your typical day was like there.
Well, they varied. We didn't have as much physical exercise as we had in boot camp, where you had physical training every day. It seemed like we had classes at times. We had maybe classes on infantry tactics and stuff like that, and then we'd go out in the field, practice them at times. So a day really varied, but if you took a month, I guess there would be probably two, three times you went out on military exercises, you know, with enveloping deals of some people shoot from the front, and then some people come around from the side, and stuff like that, and maybe some weapons training with your rifles, and then classes, a lot of classes on map reading and how to use your compass and stuff like that. like that, it, like I said, each day could vary, but if you took a month, there was a lot of stuff like that. I imagine probably twice a week you did get out and go on forced marches and hikes and running, and but I don't remember it being that tough, except for some of those hills around Penland we had to get up into. Probably once every 2 months we would have probably a week out in the field where we'd have, you know, stay overnight and have exercises and stuff like that, because I remember the flares, you know, you'd be a night maneuvers and they'd shoot these flares up where it'd light up the whole area, you know, stuff like that. So it really varied. I don't think I have too many memories specifics of that. It was just stuff like that. When I go back in memory, I guess that's about all I can say. You know, it's 40 years ago, and I can't remember too much more. I remember the food again. I always thought the food was good. That's right. Once a year, we got stuck on KP for a week, and that was fine. That was kind of a break from the training that we normally did, and I think most of us found that enjoyable. I remember in the mess hall where I worked, Joe DiMaggio's son was there. He was on mess duty one time before I went on. He died probably 6 years ago. I don't know if you read that, but he died living in a junkyard, in a small trailer, you know. And I think that was Joe's only child, but, you know, they never had any connection between them. And the other I could have mentioned at boot camp that I forgot. On the back of one of the walls, the Everly brothers had been in boot camp there and each carved their name in the back of the wall. And then the other person that was in my platoon was, if you remember Glenn Miller Band?
Mm-hmm.
His son was in our platoon. Steve Miller. I think it was Steve. Anyway, photographers come in and took pictures of him and interviewed him that. And I remember the DIs giving him a hard time of being here or whatever, you know. But he was in our platoon. But I can't remember too much more about specifics anyway about being in the infantry training regiment, not in the ITR, but in the regular Marine Corps regiment in Camp Pendleton. It was, you know, we had liberty. I think, yeah, every weeknd. That's right. During the weeknight weekend, but we'd go into Oceanside on the bus, and there was a USO in there. We'd get cheap snacks and things, and maybe go to a movie sometime. Or I know one time we went in there and got in trouble. There was four of us, and one of my buddies, he became a corporal later, but anyway, he had a fake ID, and we went and bought some booze with it, and the damn operator of the liquor store called the cops on us, and they came and stopped us there. Two SWAT cars came, which kind of surprised me, because nowadays I go, you know, let people off easier. Anyway, I got caught because I was the one that carried the booze after we got out of there. And my buddy got caught with the fake ID. And they threw us both in jail. The other two guys got to go. But they were smart-ass cops. I remember you're in pretty good shape in the Marine Corps. And I had this pint of whiskey stuck under my belt. And they come and shine the light on me. And the cops said, "Oh, gee, you pregnant?" And, you know, what an asshole. He threw you up against the car and put us in jail. It was before Miranda, and this was probably 10 o'clock at night. And they left me in there, and I guess the other guy, too. For about an hour and a half, they came. I was in this small little cell, and they come, and I said, "Well, when am I going to get out?" And they said, "Oh, when you sign a confession," you know, just like that, nothing about lawyers or anything. So I sat in this small cell. I think it was like 3 in the morning when they came back again. And I remember this little cell I was in. Somebody had scratched on the wall, you know, "Smile, you're on candid camera." Well, I was 17 years old, you know, and stuck in jail out in California. I didn't have a lot to smile about. But I got out at 3 in the morning and went back. Of course, then you're in trouble with the Marine Corps, too. It wasn't a big deal, but they don't like it. Well, anyway, my lieutenant, he was dealing with the courts and that. And we never had a lot of money then. Nowadays, they're not rich, the people in the service, but they get more than we did. We were always broke. You know, you had to pay for your uniforms and everything. So he had me borrow money from everybody in the platoon that had a dollar or two, and I ended up with, I think it was like $32 and something. And I had to go before the judge in Oceanside then, and you know, he judged me guilty. And, of course, he charged me the exact amount of money I had in my pocket, you know, $32.42, whatever it was, took every penny that I had. So, you know, there was collusion between the lieutenant and the judge. Anyway, so that's one of the memories I have there. But I guess, I don't know, you know, other than the food, I always look back on the food, and some people complain about the food. And we had good food in our family. Coming from the Midwest, you know, people I thought were pretty good cooks back there. But I almost like the food in the Marine Corps. You got more than you ever wanted to eat, and there was a variety of stuff. So that was always a good memory of mine with the service. And I do remember in those days, like I said about money, we got paid every 2 weeks, and you got paid in cash in those days. And as a private, I remember we got like, I think it was $80 a month, or 82 or something like that. And everybody was broke after the first week, after you paid for your haircuts and you paid this and that. And we had a little allotment taken out, so you'd have some savings when you got out. But we were, after 1 week, I think like 70, 80% of the people were broke after 1 week. And then that next week, everybody, you couldn't have buy cigarettes or couldn't do anything, you know, so.
And that was $82 for every 2 weeks or for the month?
That was for the month.
For the month.
Yeah.
Now, so what was Joe DiMaggio's son like? Did you get a chance to fraternize with him at all?
No. He was in a different platoon, and he was on KP duty, one of the servers as we went through the line, you know. And they just said, you know, you could see he looked like Joe in a way. But I did no fraternization or ever talked to anybody that had talked to him or whatever. You know, he was just a, kind of another guy. You really didn't get to know guys in other platoons. You know the guys in your platoon. A company is made up of four platoons. In fact, he was in a different company even.
Mm-hmm. And so what about Steve Miller, Glenn Miller's son? What was he like?
Well, that was boot camp, and then there you talked a lot with the people right around where your rack was, your bed, but you didn't get to know a lot of the other people. You know, you had to shut your mouth most of the time, and you had a little bit of time on Sunday to read the newspaper and as they call it, grab ass, which is talk with the other Marines and that, and maybe a little time after you come in right before bed, but you didn't get to know him that much. He seemed like a nice fellow. He kept his mouth shut and went with the program, as they'd say, you know, and then tried to do good in there, and then he did, I think. But yeah, it just you never knew too many people in boot camp, especially.
Okay. What about? Let's see here. What I was going to ask you. Oh, your GED. Tell me about your GED. When did you have to get your GED along the way?
Well, we didn't have to get it. I just did it. They brought it up. So many of us were high school dropouts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was at Camp Pendleton that I did that. It wouldn't have been over in Okinawa. It could have been. I can't remember now. But they just said, here's that avenue, you know, you can if you didn't complete high school, you can get your GED and so I don't remember studying for the darn thing. Maybe there was a study book or something, but I don't remember how many people took it. I just remember it passed, and that was, nobody said anything. We just did it, I guess. They said you got a letter or something, you passed, and that was about it. So.
All right. Tell me a little bit, Mr. Narby, about when you first enter the Marine Corps and as your time in Camp Pendleton extended over time, how did you feel about what was going on in Vietnam and your chances of being sent over there?
Well, when we entered, I don't know, I guess there was advisors there then, but I only know that from in the last maybe 20 years later. I didn't know anything about it. We were we were in Pendleton for a year and a half, and then we went to Okinawa. We were on float. When we were in Pendleton, never heard the word Vietnam.
Okay.
Even though there were, I'm sure there were advisors there then, maybe not too many, but Kennedy was president then. So, well, that's one other thing. We guarded the street for President Kennedy in San Diego. I don't know if I told you that. We guarded the streets. President Kennedy came to San Diego.
Okay.
And we guarded the streets for him down there. And I happened to be on, we stood along the street, you know, along the route he was going. And it was kind of interesting. I got to be, I suppose, within 3-4 feet of him because his car came in the side of the road where I was. And we were kind of supposed to look at the crowd, you know, to see that nobody rushed in. But a lot of us turned when his car came right by us to look at him. And it's funny, I can remember the car going by, and a buddy of mine took the picture of it, a buddy who didn't have duty that day, so we got pictures of that, but I don't remember seeing his face at all. I remember turning around and looking and thinking, gosh, I shouldn't have did that, maybe, but anyway, going on about Vietnam, nothing in California, and I don't think we had any training for it either. When we got to Okinawa, we did guerrilla warfare training, which was because there was a jungle-like area on Okinawa, and I imagine they were getting us ready in case something happened in Vietnam. But even over there, never knew any. I don't think I ever heard the word. We had a company go over there to do a little scouting work one time, and I remember it was Tiger Tooth Mountain they went to and stayed like a maybe a month and worked with the Mountain Yard people, I think that's how you pronounce it. But even then, we didn't hear the name Vietnam or anything, and that anything bad was going to happen or could happen. I mean, it was peacetime, you know, as far as we were concerned. And I didn't know there was advisors there until later, I don't think. And why that company went there, we really didn't know. We got sent all over on Fort Battalion. We went to the Philippines. We went to Formosa. We went to, well, Philippines 3 times and did maneuvers and things, and for most of the same thing a couple times, so it wasn't anything that much out of the ordinary. So didn't know anything about Vietnam. We didn't have TV over there, and if radio, a couple of the troops had a radio, it was always on to music or something, and newspapers, we hardly ever read a newspaper over there, so we were pretty much unaware, had no idea that anything was happening, because that was 63 and 64, we was over in Okinawa, but no, Vietnam, I don't think I ever heard the name, you know, and until we were offshore on a ship was about it, so.
And so what month in 63 did you go over to Okinawa?
Well, we was in Okinawa about a year, so if we left around November of 64, I think we left like, you know, November or December of 63.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And had you already been in the Philippines in Formosa before that, or?
No, we went over and got set up in Okinawa itself at Camp Schwab, the Marine Corps base over there. And then from there we would go on ships, you know, at least twice to the Philippines, I think 3 times, and to Formosa and then to Hong Kong. Not on the same trip, but a lot of the time. We'd go and pull a 2-week maneuver or 3-week maneuver in one of those places, and then go back to Okinawa for a couple months and stuff like that, you know. But yeah, that was after we got established at our base over there. We were called Full Battalion 1-3, 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines. And that's the one that they, I guess they get ready for landings, you know, so they have all the training aboard ships and how to get the troops all around or whatever, you know.
And when you left for Okinawa, where did you take off from?
Long Beach, California.
Okay. And so tell me about your jungle training in Okinawa.
Well, we did that maybe twice for a period of maybe 2 weeks, maybe a week each time. It's been a long time ago. But a lot of it was night training in the jungle, using compasses and things of, you know, you start out here and you got to go through this jungle area and you got 3-4 hours to go through it and to keep quiet. And they'd punji traps. They had talked about punji traps and showed us they had set up ones there and stuff like that. But it's mainly getting through the jungles at night with using just a compass and stuff like that. You know, maybe have to go 5 miles through the jungle in so many hours and to get from point A and end up at point B where they wanted you to end up at. It was that type of stuff. I don't remember them training, having people dressed up as gorillas or anything. It was mainly night training and stuff like that. And, you know, it wasn't too hard because you couldn't go very fast. And it was at night, so it wasn't very hot. It was halfway enjoyable training. But I'm looking back at it, I'm guessing that was because there was advisors in Vietnam at that time, and there was, you know, Vietnam was starting to heat up. So we had that over there. But the main thing I remember is the punji traps, you know, watch out for punji traps. And they had some built there and showed what they were like.
And what were punji traps?
Well, punji traps were the North Vietnamese or whatever, they dig a hole in the ground, maybe 3-4 feet deep, 3-5 feet wide, and then they put sticks in the ground in the bottom of it, and they sharpen the top of the sticks, and then they put human dung on them, so when you fall in there, they stick in you, and of course you get infected in that.
Wow. And then would they set up these traps where they were ready to ambush you as well, or was more that it would just injure you and get infected and slow you down?
Well, from the training there, I took it to be just that you were injured and slowed down.
Okay.
We had no setup of ambushes there. We did have ambush training up there, too. I forgot about that, but not around the punji traps that I remember.
Okay. So tell me about when you first discovered that something was going on in Vietnam and you guys might be sent to Vietnam.
Well, we were on float battalion. We'd been, I forget where we'd been, if it was the Philippines that time or Formosa or whatever. But we were on the South China Sea area someplace. And we'd been on the ship for like a month and a half. And, it, you know, to us it was peacetime. We never had any idea there'd been no big combat since the Korean War. And I think the only other worried time we had was, well, when the Cuban Missile Crisis popped up, we thought things would get hot then. But anyway, we was on full battalion for probably a month and a half or so, and there was nothing new about that because we'd done that a lot of the time, you know. That was what we were, was the float battalion over there. And then on one day on ship, this communique comes through, and of course they give us a copy of it, that President Johnson has started bombing North Vietnam. Well, that's when we first started to think, hey, you know, something's happening here. And then two or three days later, I guess it was, we get up in the morning and there was this big country off the side of the ship, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles off the side of the ship, and somebody said, well, that's Vietnam over there. And we said, oh, well, green, that's what I remember about it. It was just so lush green. There was no town where we were or anything, and beautiful, looked beautiful from the ocean out there. And so that made us think a little bit more, and I think they talked more about the bombings that were happening and stuff like that. And then I guess three times, they got us loaded up with live ammo and hand grenades, live grenades and things. And we've been on many training missions with the helicopter and that, but we were on a helicopter carrier, I think it was the Valley Forge, many of the big choppers up on the flight deck, and got us up there. And then they revved the choppers up, you know, and never told us we weren't going in. We assumed we were, and they got them all going, and, you know, they're noisy as heck, but when we got on those before, we usually hollered at each other about, well, I wonder where we're going now, and BS back and forth, you know. And because this here, I never forget this, that if nobody said anything to anybody else. We held our rifle in our hands and looked straight ahead, you know, thinking within an hour we could be dead. Because they never said we weren't going to go in. They talked about the LZ's landing zones that were in there where we might be hitting and stuff like that before we went up to the helicopters in. But they never, I don't know if they did that to just train us to see how long it takes to get the people up to the copters or get us used to that we might be going into combat when it had been peacetime for a number of years. I have no idea, but we did that at least twice, maybe three times. Right. I never forgot that when we got on the helicopters in, nobody ever said anything. We'd always holler and BS with each other, and those times nobody spoke. You know, it was scary. We were, what, 18 then, I guess, or 19, and so were a lot of the other guys, you know. So, and when we got off the helicopter, we never really talked about it. You know, nobody said anything. You would think you would, you know, well, why, are they going to do this, or are we going to be in combat in a day, and kind of kept quiet about it. We were kids when you look back on it, you know, 18, 19 years old. So.
That must have been pretty scary.
Well, it was. And half of us were due to get out in 6 months. We were on a three-year enlistment. So that was, the bombing was August of 64, September, October, November. Yeah, 5 or 6 months. We were due to get out, too. And that's the main thing, I think, that was on our minds a lot of the time. You always talk about that when you're getting out of that damn Marine Corps, you know. And we really didn't want to get extended in anything. And I think the other thing I told you about on ship, these are huge ships, you know. We never went to church, but when that came up, I thought, you know, I better go to church, you know, and start thinking about mortality or whatever. And I went down that Sunday wanting to get a little solace from that. And there was such a line trying to get into church that Sunday that I think twice I did that. You couldn't even get near the chapel, you know, before. Nobody ever went after that. A lot of people were trying to get in there and make a little peace with God or whatever, I guess.
They were thinking the same thing you were thinking or similar.
I remember being quite disappointed that I couldn't get in there and say a couple of prayers, you know, because, oh, man, that was important to me that day.
And how much had church played a role when you were growing up?
Well, there was, I guess, a two-year period my parents went for a while and went fairly regularly. But that was about all 2 or 3 year period, I think, mainly. And after that, it didn't pay any importance whatsoever, it didn't seem like. You know, nothing at home mentioning about religion or whatever. So it wasn't much.
So before you had these 2 or 3 times when they got you on the helicopter and you thought you were being taken over to Vietnam, what were your thoughts at that point about being in the Marine Corps? Were you happy with it, disenchanted with it, just counting the days to get out?
We made a lot of good friends in there. And the infantry part, again, the food I liked, and there were some training sessions that I didn't like, some of the forced marches we'd go on where we'd go on a 20-mile hike in the morning. And they were really fast marches. People with shorter legs have to run every so many steps to keep up. And that I never cared for too much because I was flat-footed and my feet hurt so bad. But you just passed the pain aside and forgot about it until you got back to the barracks when you could hardly walk. But other than, no, it was good. You know, we got to the Philippines. We got to Formosa. We went to Hong Kong on those float, you know, on the ships out in the sea. They sometimes showed movies at night on the decks. And it was good. It was really a good experience, the whole part of that. Like I said, boot camp, no. But the other part of it was. There was a lot of good things happening in there. Okinawa was beautiful. I still like Okinawa and miss it. You know, it was a nice experience, the whole part of it. Overseas, much more so than Pendleton, I thought. Things were a little more lax over there. You didn't have to be quite as spiffy as you did on Camp Pendleton. You didn't have to shine your boots as much, and your clothes didn't have to be as starched, quite as starched. It was more relaxed overseas. We just went so many places, you know. Japan, we were in Japan a couple times. We were in Hawaii a couple times. It was good. Yeah, I enjoyed the whole thing. I think the thing that we mainly worried about the coast of Vietnam, one was getting killed, but the other was, were we going to get extended and not get home? We were waiting to get out in 6 months, you know, and then that was the important thing on our minds. Most people bitch a lot about, well, I'm, you know, 14 months I'm out of this damn thing. You bitch and bitch about the service. I remember, I guess we had a lieutenant, Terry, we had a short little guy. guy. We called him Little Lord Fauntleroy. He was from the East Coast, but once in a while they'd have us do the cleaning session. But this was in Pendleton, and one of our guys from Detroit made up this song, which we'd sing at the top of our voices. And it was a short little ditty that we'd sing. I'm surprised they didn't jump on us for it, but it went this way. You know, the Marine Corps flag is a dirty old rag, and the commandant is a fairy. How he hate to work with that dirty little jerk, our Lieutenant Terry. We'd sing that over and over.
Did they heard you? The higher-ups heard this?
Well, the sergeants sure did, because they were having to watch to see if we did the cleaning. This is when they'd make us clean at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, which would piss us off. We'd break out with that one and sing it out over and over.
And the sergeants, they would not be singing along, would they?
Oh, no. I'm sure they didn't, you know. But I thought the guy who wrote that, he did a pretty good job on that, you know, with getting Lieutenant Terry in there and then the commandant and the flag and everything. You know, it was pretty good. But we had, you know, a couple of, since you're in the Marine Corps, you can bet you about the other things. You know, USMC stood for Uncle Sam's Misguided Children, and then the other was Unorganized Shit and Mass Confusion. So, you know, you denigrated the Marine Corps every chance you got when you was in there. It was never anything. It was a great organization, to you.
And this would happen when you were overseas in Okinawa as well, or was it primarily in Camp Pendleton?
It was more in Camp Pendleton because they were stricter then, and that's where we had many of these midnight deals of cleaning the barracks, you know. But not as much in Okinawa. We were on ship a lot. We were traveling around, and like I said, it was more lax over there. And they told us that before we went over there. When you get overseas, it's going to be a little more lax duty. And it was, you know. Pendleton, you know, that's kind of the showplace of the Marine Corps. And I guess Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego is the real showplace, but Camp Pendleton for the infantry place, you know. So it's a lot more spit and polish there.
So what were your favorite countries that you went to, or your favorite places that you went to once you were on the ship?
Well, Okinawa would be the favorite, but where we went to on the ship and other places, Hawaii was beautiful to go through because we went into Pearl Harbor, you know, and docked in there. And I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a long, narrow way to get in there, and it's beautiful. But we only stayed in Hawaii for just an overnight each time. We went to, Hong Kong was interesting. Just, we'd been to Formosa and that, but they took us up to the border of Red China, you know, and things that was interesting. But the favorite, maybe the Philippines, you know, just for the liberty we had there. But none of them stand out like Okinawa itself did. You know, Okinawa was just a beautiful island. I remember when we left it to come back to the States for the final time, most of us stood on the fantail of the ship for probably an hour just looking at Okinawa as it disappeared in the distance. You know, we all were very fond of it.
Was it just a beautiful place?
It was. You know, it was. And the people were friendly at the time, and Liberty was good there. You know, there was cheap drinks, and there were some nice bases that had slot machines that were real cheap to play and stuff like that. You know, one other incident I'll tell you on the way over to Okinawa, when we were docked at Yokohama Harbor overnight, and we got up in the morning. They get you up 4:30 or 5 o'clock. Have you ever been on a big ship where it's military-like, where you're in one area there's probably 100 servicemen, and then you go through a door and there's another 100 in this next bay area, and so on, and the bowels of the ship, you know. And we woke up in Yokohama probably about 4:35 in the morning. You always got up early. They got you up early even if there's nothing to do. Anyway, waking up, and we had this Sergeant Kennedy who was the biggest a-hole we ever thought there was, and he was total spit and polish and a jerk. And in the, we heard in the about two bays down, somebody said, it was morning when we got up, somebody said, hey, they shot Kennedy, you know. And they thought, well, somebody shot Sergeant Kennedy when he was on Liberty the night before. And the next, went to the next band, guys cheered, you know, oh, they shot Kennedy, hey, hey, you know. And it came to ours, and the same thing happened. Well, we found out about a half hour later it was President Kennedy that had been assassinated. And I remember on the ship that day, it was so quiet because he was our commander-in-chief and we'd guarded the streets for him that nobody hardly spoke for the whole day. They just kind of wandered around up or sat in places up topside on the ship, and you didn't even speak to your friends very much. It was kind of really a sad time for us. But for a while, I thought it was our Sergeant Kennedy, and everybody cheered that somebody had shot him.
Interesting. So you would say
not a lovable guy.
So most of the men there had quite a bit of admiration for President Kennedy then.
All of us did, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Was it primarily because he was a commander-in-chief and you had a chance to guard him when he came into San Diego, or do you think it was the whole image of Camelot?
I think it was more that we guarded the streets and that, because Camelot we didn't know too much about. We didn't have TV, and we didn't read much newspapers and that, and like I said, radio was mainly music on. So I think part of it was, too, we were out of the country, and this was happening back in our country, and we weren't there, and you wondered what's going on or whatever. But, yeah, it was guarding the streets for him and, you know, seeing him and him being our commander-in-chief. And then they had pictures of him in different offices, you know, and they still do in the military, you know, pictures of the president around. So, yeah, but not the Camelot part. He was a youthful, vigorous person, you know, yeah.
And did you, when you were over on the ship, did you find out much about what happened when he was assassinated, or was the news pretty limited?
Oh, it was quite limited. Yeah, quite limited. We didn't know much at all. I didn't, you know, I don't think we'd seen a newspaper until we probably got to Okinawa then, and maybe read something about it. And we didn't buy newspapers very often. We didn't get many of them, but never did. I think I found out most about it when I got out of the service, and you know, there's TV reports or specials on it or something like that, but not at the time. We didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about in Okinawa? Did you guys fraternize with the Japanese women when you would go out on the weekends?
Well, maybe some we got to know in restaurants and things like that. But fraternization was mainly with prostitutes that people did.
And were there a lot of those in Okinawa?
Oh, yeah. Okinawa and the Philippines. And well, I don't remember many in Formosa. I don't remember any over in Formosa, but in the Philippines and in Okinawa. Yeah, kind of sadly, there was a lot of the girls were prostitutes, you know, and there was a lot of military on Okinawa. There was an Air Force base, there was an Army base, and there was a Marine Corps base in Okinawa. It's not that big of an island, so.
And were these oftentimes young girls, or were they adult women?
Oh, they were always adults. I think, I would say they were at least 17, 18 years old at the very youngest, and some in their 30s and older, you know.
So tell me more about your experiences in Okinawa.
Well, we'd probably run once every week or something for exercise. We took 20-mile hikes probably once every 2 months. We'd do that in the morning. I remember they were kind of rough. But then we had classes and stuff like that, a lot of training classes, and then nuclear biological and chemical warfare, and it was more of a lax time over there, I guess. You couldn't go on Liberty until I think it was noon Saturday. That was the only difference, where in the States you could leave at Friday night after 5 o'clock. So it shortened your Liberty. But just the whole thing itself, I don't remember it being that rough. It was almost like a tropical vacation at times, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the South China Sea was right outside our barracks, and it was a beautiful place, beautiful area, Camp Schwab.
Was it right on the beach, or?
Well, yeah, our base was. You know, some of the bases were inland, like Kadena Air Force Base was more inland, but Okinawa is not a very big island. I think it's like 60 miles long and I forget how miles wide. But, yeah, ours was right on the beach. It was not low, but it was up higher, but right, the beach was just, you know, down just a very little way, so you're fine. But we spent so much time on ship, too, traveling around that I think that made it nice, too. We weren't stuck in one place all the time, but when we were left on Okinawa, we all loved it. I don't think any of us ever said, boy, we want to get off this place or this place is a dump or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
It was fantastic, you know. It was just a nice place.
Now, going back to the prostitutes, was the military their primary clients?
I don't know that. I would assume that there was also Oriental clients in that. But that's just an assumption on my part. I really don't know. Since there were so many military men there, I imagine that was a big portion of their clients. But I would assume that there was also Orientals. You know, you would think so.
And were the Japanese pretty friendly to you?
The Japanese, you know, at that time there wasn't the trouble that there is now with that base. You've read about, you know, the problems they've had over there, and I think the Japanese took control of the islands back here, but in the past 10, 15 years, the Ryukyu Islands, they are. They were friendly at the time. I don't remember hardly any being unfriendly. They were nice people. You know, they were really nice people.
Did many of them speak English?
Yeah, enough to take your orders in the restaurant and things like that. And that's the main thing we've seen, was going into a restaurant or a bar or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if we went to bars, we mainly went to the bars on our base because drinks were cheaper,
mm-hmm.
a lot cheaper there. But we did go to restaurants in town, and, yeah, they could talk. And I remember, you know, some of the girls are really just nice, friendly. These weren't prostitutes or anything, but they were nice people. They were awfully friendly people over there.
And what kind of a salary did you have every month? Was it still the $82 a month, or did you get paid more
I think it maybe got up to 110 or 120 a month or something like that when I'm 83 over there. But it still wasn't a lot, but things were cheaper over there too, you know. So we didn't spend as much money, I don't think.
So there was more room to go out and socialize and go to the restaurants and bars and stuff.
Yeah, the meals were cheap, you know, cheaper than they'd have been in town in Oceanside. So we went out more. But then, you know, we rose a couple ranks, too, from E1 to E3 and with cheaper stuff. So, but we were on ship a lot of the time. I think we saved more money because of that, too. If you're on a float battalion on the ship, you can't buy much at all. So there was many times that probably a month and a half, we'd have a month and a half's pay coming when we got back and hadn't any chance place to spend it. So we went on more trips around there to the different bases maybe and have some drinks or whatever at the base bars and stuff. So there was more money available over there. But because of those reasons, I guess, mainly of sitting on ship a lot.
Now on the ships, how many helicopters do they have on the ships?
Oh, it's just a guess. It was a good, if you look at the aircraft carriers now and you see pictures of those on TV, they weren't quite that big, but still they were huge carriers. And I'm guessing up top, maybe 30 choppers sitting up on the deck up there.
Okay. So when you had the two or three times when you thought you were being sent over to Vietnam, approximately when was this time frame wise?
Well, it was September of 1964.
Okay.
I'm guessing probably within 2 weeks after the bombing started, you know. August, September of 64. There was no big units in, you know, I think I told you before, they were going to send us in as a battalion, but we'd been on ship by that time for probably 3 months. So they decided we were probably too much out of shape. So they took us out of the area, and they brought the next battalion in, and they did go in as a group. And I think they were the first large battalion-wise group to go into Vietnam was the one that replaced us then. But if we hadn't been on ship so long, we would have probably went in then. But they figured, you know, that hot jungle and that, and being sitting on ship for 3 months, you're kind of out of shape.
No, so when the next battalion came in, they came in and they switched you out on the ship, or how did that work?
No, they brought them in on a different ship.
Okay.
And shipped us back to Okinawa. See, we were the 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, so there was also the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines, and the 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines. So they shipped us back to Okinawa, and then I'm guessing it was 2-3 or 3-3 that went over there and went in as a unit then. But they were the first big military unit to go into Vietnam.
And then when now, for the men that were in your battalion, were they all in the same time frame in terms of they all did boot camp at the same time, so they were going to get out at the same time of the military?
I don't know that for sure. I know that a lot of people in our battalion were, but I don't know that the 2nd Battalion or the 3rd Battalion were the same thing. I have no idea. Talking to some of my friends later, they did talk about some of the people who were automatically extended. You know, it was wartime, so they just said, no. You know, you were due to get out in such and such a time, but sorry, you know, you're 6 months more over here. So I'm not too sure about the other battalions. You know, we mainly got to know the people in our own platoon, then some in our own company, but not hardly any in other companies. You mainly knew the people in your own platoon.
And so now, but everybody in your platoon was on the same time frame in terms of when they were getting out for 3 years.
Say that again.
Everybody in your platoon was scheduled to get out approximately February of
65? No, about half of them were.
Half
of us were three-year people.
Okay.
We signed up for 3 years, which we always thought was extremely lucky. And the other half signed up for 4 years. So they had a year and a half, but we had like 6 months left before we got out, so...
Okay, so now those in your platoon that were on the four-year plan, did a lot of them end up going into Vietnam?
Well, they did, but they went back to the States first. You know, as a battalion, we went back to San Diego, all of us. But, yeah, three, four guys in my platoon died over there. I know that from reading the book that shows the names on the wall. And from talking to different people, a lot of them went back to Vietnam and served in Vietnam. But six people or three-year people, when we got back to the States, we got back in like November, early December of 64. Well, they discharged us within about 3 weeks, because it wasn't worth their money, they said, to send all of us on to new bases for 2 months and then discharge us. So we actually got an early out. But those other people, yeah, they did. Yeah, many of them went back to Vietnam and fought over there.
And then how many men were in your platoon?
Well, there's like 40 men in a platoon.
Okay. And so you, as far as you know, there were about three of them that were killed in Vietnam of the ones that went back?
Yeah, four or five were
okay.
Killed over there.
Any of them were good friends of yours?
I wouldn't say close friends. My close friends were mainly the three-year people. But the two of them I knew quite well, yeah, Breton, and I think it was Breton and another person, yeah, a couple of them I knew quite well.
So that must have been hard for you.
Well, it was probably 15 years, 20 years later, 30 years later when I found out about it, so, you know, time really changes. I think your feeling is more of, I'll be damned, you know, poor person, or you feel sorry for him, but, yeah.
So any other things that you would like to share with me? Any other memorable experiences or anything else about your military experience that I haven't asked about?
Let me think. I guess I can't really think of anything right now that stands out. You know, we covered most of it and some of the lowlights and highlights, I guess, of time. No, I can't think of specifics, Stephanie. Nothing at all.
What would you say, Mr. Norby, to young people who have never seen war, have never been in the military? What would you want them to understand about the military?
Oh. Well, I think it's a plus that almost everybody should be forced to go in the military. It changes your perspective on life and it makes you work and be regimented and grow up a lot. I think it'd do a lot of good for a lot of people. Getting into combat, further people probably didn't have to do that because it's such a stressor on their lives and the injuries. Or a lot of people get killed and a lot of people are maimed. And although I think we have to have wars and we have to do things. So the combat, no, but the military, yeah, I think it'd be good for a lot of young men. And I think more so now, much more so now than it was in 1962 when I went in, because it was a different society when I went in compared to what it is now. You know, it's pretty, I don't know, wayward, a lot of wayward youth nowadays who use it.
Could use the discipline, or?
Yeah, the discipline, and I think it'd help them grow up a lot. It's needed pretty much, you know. A lot of drug people and things like that, you know. I could change the lives of a lot of them for the better.
When you were speaking of drugs, when you were over there, were there very many men that were in smoking pot or into other types of drugs?
I never knew a person that did drugs in 62, 63, and 64.
Okay.
Never one. We, you know, a lot of alcohol. But overseas, we could drink legally at 18, whatever. But no, I never seen a drug in the service.
Now, back home, was the drinking age 21 in most states, or was it 18, or?
Well, it was, I think it was 18 in South Dakota.
Okay.
But it, you know, that was for 5.5% beer or something, a very weak beer. You can get the harder beer. North Dakota was 21. But yeah, in California, I think it was 21 in California. But overseas, it just, you know, if you were in the service over there, you go to the service club and drink, you know, that was about it, so.
Now, the charges that were brought against you in California, did those cause a problem for you later on in work life, or were they non-existent, essentially?
Oh, they were non-existent.
Okay.
Never had a problem with them at all.
Okay. What about, Mr. Narby, my last question for you is, how would you say the fact that you were very close to being sent to combat affected your life?
Well, I don't know. You know, I guess maybe it's just thinking about what it would have been like. And you know, we all seen Vietnam on TV for hours and hours over the years we have anyway. I think just with probably in my thought process only a little bit, and that's like 20% of me feels I should have went there too, like the rest of the people, and that 20% also feels they missed out on something that, you know, a lot of people don't do. Now the greater part of me is glad that I did not have to go and get in there and march in those hot, sweltering jungles and get a lot of people maimed or killed, which could have happened to yourself. But I guess that's the only thing I think about is yeah, missed out on it, you know, and missed out on something and the experience of doing it. But 80% of me says, no, I'm damn glad I didn't have to then and didn't do it.
Tell me more about the 20%. Why does the 20% of you feel like you missed out? What do you feel like you missed out on? Was it more of a responsibility or not? Tell me more.
I think more of curiosity and things, and you know, all the TV you've seen of the shows in Vietnam where they're filming what happened over there, and that, you know, there's just something interesting and exciting about that, you know, the experience that they went through and being able to say they did it. Yeah, I was over in Vietnam, you know, and I guess when you went in the service, there was no combat from 1953 or 54 when Korea ended until the other. So when you went in the service during those years, you got back, it was kind of a big deal, wasn't it? Yeah, I served my time in the service. Yeah, he was in the Marine Corps. He was in the Army, you know. Well, when Vietnam came, that kind of eclipsed that, because then it was just, well, he was in the war. If you've just been in the service, it was nothing. You see what the point I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
Your experience in the service from 53 to 64, it was kind of a big deal. That, yeah, you went and served. But then, after Vietnam was on for 6, 7, 8 years, it was only if you were in the service it was a big deal. Only if you were in combat it was a bigger deal. You know, than there. But I don't know if I thought about that too much, but it was just all the TV shows that, you know, where the news people had filmed this going on in Vietnam and that going on, and just something about that, you know, part of me always wishes I could have been there, but the greater part of me, like I said, does not, so.
And what did you end up doing when you got back after the military?
Well, I worked at a few jobs, and then I went out to Washington State, where I had an aunt out here, and a grandmother, and then a couple cousins, and they said they had a nice mill out here, and then they also had a junior college, and why don't I come out here? And you're from a small town in Dakota, you know, what do you do? You either go to Fargo or Minneapolis or Sioux Falls or whatever, if your dad doesn't own a farm or a store.
Mm-hmm.
So I came out here, and I worked in a mill one summer, and then I went to the junior college, and eventually got my college degree in accounting. But in the summer, it was interesting. I worked one summer driving fire trucks, fighting forest fires out of Forks, Washington. Have you ever heard of the Twilight movies?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're based in Forks, Washington, you know. And so I drove fire truck fighting forest fire out of there. And then for two, that was the summer when I first got out here before I went to college. Then for two or three summers when I was going to college, I came back. I went to Eastern Washington and over by Spokane, and I came back to the Port Angeles area, Port Angeles Squim area, and I logged for three different summers, setting chokers one summer, and another summer for a logging company. I did all the dynamiting for them, building road up in the mountains, and worked at driving the loader cat for a logging company and stuff like that in the summer. Good paying jobs, you know, very good paying jobs. And then I got my college degree, of course, and got married. I left the area for a while. I worked at the Federal Trade Commission in Washington, D.C., and I was a federal auditor in Atlanta, Georgia, for a while. And then when my wife and I came back to Tacoma, and I was accountant for a federal penitentiary for a year, which and then I got out of the government service and worked for the county here for a while. Well, it's still a government, local government, though.
As an accountant?
I did, yeah.
And that's
I
where you...
6 years with the state. I was a state auditor again and worked at a state reformatory and stuff like that.
Huh, okay. So you spent most of your adult life in accounting work once you...
Yeah, sure. Accounting and auditing.
Okay. Interesting. All right, Mr. Norby, anything else you want to add before we close?
I can't think of anything.
Thank you very, very much for your time.
Yes, I enjoy talking to you, Stephanie.